Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are coming from. Welcome to the Controversial Exchange. This is your host, Ryan O. Before we jump into it, I just want to do a quick reminder, all right? The Anchor app. This is a really cool way to call in, and we can actually just, boop, drop you straight into the episodes. If you have any thoughts or feedback as you're listening to these, make sure that you hop over there, anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange. Today's our first back and forth with myself and Dimitri, so let's just roll that intro. All right, welcome to the Controversial Exchange. Man, we have a really exciting one here for you. We went all over the map, man. It started with narrative, right?
Oh, dude, it was, yes. And back and forth, and there and back again, a controversial exchange story.
So our plan on this was just to kind of start seeing where we can riff on the microphone, what that turns out to be. There's a whole lot of articles referenced, different things out there and tools referenced. This starts to become a theme on self-management and narrative and what's your own story. How do you pursue and understand those sort of things?
Sure. Self-management is a big one.
Yeah, I'm really excited to share it with y'all. Do you have any, I guess, anything to intro with here?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that I hope that when people listen to it, they approach it with an open mind and they don't look at the terminological way that we talk, like the words that we use to talk about it, even though they're not behavioral and we're not necessarily using them in a mentalistic way. We're just using them to describe how we feel about a particular thing, and that they could potentially be broken down and described behavior analytically if we really needed to do that. But that's for research articles and that's for publication. That's not for open discussion and discourse and dialectic when people are trying to exchange ideas in everyday conversation.
Yeah, and that's the goal of this. As always, like, there's other outlets and different people that tackle different things on podcasts. So if there's anything relevant, we'll link other podcasts and maybe break some of this down or whatnot. But that is the point of it. Hope you enjoy. Buckle up. Here we go. Bam, look at that. We're recording. Rock and roll. Welcome to the Controversial Exchange Podcast. We're hyped. We're stoked. We're pulling up our materials. We're getting ready. This is actually perfect because I'm really fresh off of this reading on this topic in a few different ways. And there's a special issue, and I read a bunch of the special issue sort of work. So in Perspectives of Behavior Science, what used to be called the Behavior Analyst. Now they have, they did a special issue on narrative. And so it started with this Phil Heinlein article talking about how we should try to understand what's going on in narrative. Basically, he cites, like, you could approach it from any different sort of approach, whether you want to look at it through verbal behavior, if you want to look through the different component skills when it comes to generalized imitation, those sort of skill sets that are needed to be able to share and spread stories. You can look at it from the naming literature, from the RFT literature. He pulled it apart from all these different angles. But the thing is there, it's not a really solid conceptual analysis. Yeah, there's a whole lot of components that are involved. And it's a good starting first article, but it's not comprehensive and, like, it's not like a Beowulf Rizzi 1968 where, like, boom, we laid it out. Here it is. It's just kind of the first starting article. And then there was a bunch of different people that replied to him. Two in particular that were super cool was Ronnie Dietrich. We'll get to that one in a second. And then Critchfield. Critchfield, Tom Critchfield. Have you read any of his work?
Yeah, I've read some of his work.
Yeah.
I read some stuff that he did on matching theory, I think, or matching law.
Yeah, I appreciate his rawness and just, like, I don't give a fuck about, like, just being, like, blunt and to the point. What he talks about is, like, these things need to be taken in the context of an experimental empirical line of research. And it's like, cool, let's do that. And so when I emailed and asked him and said, hey, man, like, you got any opportunities? I'd be interested in getting involved, that sort of stuff. There's nothing going on. It's just another article saying we should do this sort of stuff. And it's like, come on.
That might be I actually might disagree with that.
What? How so? Explain.
It depends on when he says empirical research. I mean, does he mean single subject behavior analytic research, or does he mean all the research that's been done in psychology in relation to personal narrative? Like, that it falls under those designs. Right. I mean, what kind of research are we talking about here? There is a ton of validation for personal narrative and that kind of thing, and how words matter. I mean, also all the VB literature basically is that, only you apply it to the way you mitigate or control your own behavior. Right.
Yeah.
So and then you have Joseph Campbell and the power of myth and the hero of 1,000 faces and stuff from the 60s and 70s. that basically lays out the hero's journey, lays out all the power of stories, the power of narrative. It's been the justification for why they write comic books the way they write them. Yeah. I mean, I'm serious though.
Yeah, like, dude. Yeah.
I found the common, what is it? I think it's the common like 18 cycles that every great epic story has had since the Epic of Gilgamesh to the Bible to Hercules to the gods of Olympus to Superman and Batman to Neo and the Matrix. I mean, like, it's literally the same story told in, with different dressing, but the highs and the lows and the emotional call and response that it creates are the same. So, I mean, do we need to have a conversation about epigenetic narrative? Maybe that would be interesting, right? An interesting way to go about that, huh?
So, I mean, to quote Critchfield exactly, he said, "Nice to hear of the interesting work that you're doing," because I had mentioned to him that I was trying to put this into a workshop format and see where it could kind of go. He said, "My perspective on all of this is that it's important to be as evidence-based as possible. Narrative is a big topic, and as a former English literature major, I can tell you that an awful lot that's said about it is just made-up stuff. If the stakes really are as high as we all pretend, then we have a moral and ethical responsibility to get this right." And I kind of feel like, yeah, cool. That's what we could say about anything that we do in behavior analysis. The fact that we're trying to influence human behavior makes that sort of statement valid, right? Cool. And then he said, "With that in mind, I have to respectfully disagree with Dr. Heinlein's recommendation that you check out personal stories told by behavior analysts." And so he referenced this book that there's a few different ones that are out. The Cambridge Center put out this book that's called Behavioral Science: Tales of Inspiration, Discovery, and Service, where they just got a bunch of people, mostly males, some females, to write in and talk about their personal stories and how they got interested in the field and such. And I personally love that stuff, man, because it's a side that you don't get with the articles, right? And it's super important. So that's what he was saying he was disagreeing with. And that's what Heinlein was referencing. And he said to finish his quote real quick, he said, quote, to continue, "For one thing, these are just generated subjectively, not empirically based." Like everything that is being written by a researcher is also falling under that. So if you're going to have your critique be that these things are subjective, the writing of these articles are also subjective. They have the same sources of an influence, right? There's no control procedures going into the way that these people are writing these things. So in my sense, my understanding, this is just an arbitrary line that a single person is drawing as to what is acceptable, not acceptable. You can say it's empiricism, but it's not. Like, sorry, you're off the mark. It's good at bat, I guess, like good swing, but it kind of strike in my book. But
yeah, it's kind of confusing descriptive and normative claims.
Yeah.
I mean, like behavior analysis in the scientific process that elucidates the underlying mechanisms or whatever principles that affect behavior. That's a descriptive claim. When you're talking about how ought one to live, that's a normative claim. So they're just different thresholds of discussion and truth.
I agree, man. So you said, "For another, there's one thing on which we have lots of accumulated evidence as a group. Behavior analysts are just plain lousy at engaging non-behavior analysts. Yes, there are exceptions like Pat Fryman, but normatively speaking, the returns are not good."
We're shitty at normative discourse because it's deductive, not inductive. So when you approach everything from an inductive perspective, you do miss the ability to have a conceptual conversation that requires deductive reasoning.
Yeah. So you said, just to kind of finish it out, "With that in mind, there's a ton of research on the effects of stories and what constitutes an effective story, but all this is from outside of behavior analysis." And he links me, I can include it, a glimpse of something that he enjoyed that is relative to that. It's actually a neuroscientist and talking about Super Bowl ads. I haven't read through it, but we'll include it for folks. So for folks listening, we're talking about this because I recently conducted a workshop in Florida testing out what's kind of been a clear change in trajectory in my field now, or my career. Of it spans back to Cal ABA 2018, that one where everybody talked about. And I had interviewed a guy named Ronnie Dietrich. And Ronnie put me onto this book called Houston, We Have a Narrative by Randy Olson. And Randy was a microbiologist. He's marine biologist. Let me correct that. Marine biologist at the University of New Hampshire. And he moved down to Southern California, went into Hollywood, went into filmmaking, storytelling, and realized that it was really hard, just like I have been, and has pursued a whole lot in the last 20 years. Summed it up in a couple different books. This is one of his most recent. And it kind of lays out how you can approach what he's learned so far into a model to try to disseminate and share in different ways. It doesn't have to be video. It could be all sorts of different ways. And his big takeaway is you talk about things in an and, but, therefore method. So he says scientists are really good at saying you should do this and this and this and this and here's all the stuff and here's more and here's more and here's more and here's more research and more research and more things to consider and more and more and more and more. And this and just gets really plain and boring and dry, right? Man, it just reminds you of every behavior analytic conference that you've probably been to. You can find an example of that sort of stuff there. And we can maybe get into that later. It's not to critique the person themselves. It's just that cultural way in which we do things has kind of been preserved, I think. But then he talks about you can have this one that's very disorganized and doesn't make sense. So rather than just listing a bunch of facts or statements or whatever it is, you can have one that's just kind of all over the place, listen to a bunch of different shit. I think I fall in that area sometimes. And the goal is to fall in the center where you're just really clear saying there's this sort of statement and then this, but when this thing comes up, this is what we should do, or therefore this is a result. And that simple narrative ABT format was what one of the co-founders of South Park, Trey, what's his last name? Yeah, Trey Parker talked about as like how he goes about trying to make a better story. He replaces his words and like his stories with that sort of framework. So anyhow, before we hit record, Dimitri and I were talking that I just got off a phone call with him. I'm going to go check out Randy Olson, not Trey Parker, that is. I got off a phone call with Randy Olson. I'm going to go check out one of his storytelling workshops that he does. There's just happened to be recording one in Boulder City, which is near Las Vegas. So I'm going to book a trip to go down there and check it out, because there's something to this, man. He's working with the national parks down there, dude. And it was really interesting. Like he's working literally with like our federal government on trying to like figure out how to get people to do better in treating our national parks in those sort of ways. And those sort of people back him. He said the biggest thing he's found is there's kind of spectrum between people that are very holistic sciences versus very analytical sciences. And he said anybody on the holistic approach, he can resonate with very, very quickly. But when it's folks over on the analytic side, they run into problems all the time. And I was like, hey, that kind of makes sense. That's probably what explains part of our field, is we're so damn analytic.
I don't know if I agree with that, but yeah.
No, why not?
Because we're not analytic. That's bullshit. We're intervention.
I think we say that we're analytic. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I think the reason I point that out is because you kept talking about the therefores and the thens and the ors, yeah, and inclusive versus exclusive ors. And again, that goes back to, I mean, what you're really describing is being able to take inductive information or empirical evidence and construct a deductive argument from it, or a convincing argument from it, right? And that's, yeah, the marriage of philosophy and science. So science gives you the data, it gives you the validation and support that represents nature, but philosophy gives you the why. So science is the what and the how, and philosophy is the why. And like when you're talking about normative conversations, you're really talking about being able to identify the why, man, and your why.
Yeah. Yeah.
Narrative is the why and the who.
In Randy's book, he was talking about how you have this issue of scientists think that they're very, very, very inductive, and like the essence of it is always a very inductive approach.
Yeah, it's inductive reasoning. It's bottom up, which again, bottom up is necessary to validate a hypothesis in terms of creating adequate amount of evidence to support it and making sure that it's properly repeatable and meets all the thresholds of a scientific inquiry. But I mean, deduction is how human beings articulate points of view and concepts to each other. in a way that's cogent, because that's how you follow logical threads. What I actually, I pulled up a little book here, an old book from back in my undergrad days. If anyone wants to study logic, just like simple logic, symbolic logic, not just like word problems, here's a little logic book here with a workbook that you can get super cheap. It's probably out of print now, or you can get it.
Read it to everybody real quick.
The Beginning title. Logic by E.J. Lemon. Okay. And it's just about breaking down your P's and Q's. So taking a sentence, it's logic is the mathematics of language, man. And as a matter of fact, with RFT stuff, there's a guy named Jose Burgos from the University of Guadalajara who wrote a early critique of RFT, because he reduced it down to basically a combination of bundle theory and symbolic logic. He was wrong, only that logic doesn't account for the behavioral stuff, but as far as like general conceptions, they're very closely tied to each other.
Really? Yeah. That's cool, man. I've read a little bit in logic. I need to read more. I actually have a whole slew of books sitting on my shelf that I ordered forever ago. I don't remember where I read this, but I was reading this book called like Great Artists Steal or something like that. And they were saying that books on a bookshelf are your highest priority or something like that. If there's books on your bookshelf you haven't read are your highest priority, or should be your highest priority. And I was like, man, there's so many things that I've like dabbled in, but I haven't finished or whatnot. I think the interesting implications for this sort of narrative structure in our field is, like you were saying, there's a ton of evidence we can point to outside of the field of behavior analysis, whether it's what you talked about, whether it's what's talked about in Randy Olson's field, in his book, whether you're talking about the thing that Tom Critchfield linked to me. There are so many examples. Yeah, and if anybody wants an example, like look at all the 150 plus pseudo treatments for autism and like figure out what they're doing. They're using good stories and case examples to be able to push and peddle what's going on. I've talked about this, but there's data in the sense of like your graphs and your journals and that sort of shit. But then there's your actual data. That is the things available to you, which in this case, the data do include all those other fields that are doing this sort of stuff that I listed before. And that to me is plenty evidence enough that we should be exploring this sort of thing. And I don't agree with Critchfield in the sense of like, yes, we have to get it right, but like us not doing stuff is just as harmful potentially as trying to move forward into it with an empirical mindset, right? Like ignorance may be bliss, but it actually hurts people too when you have the power of something that can maybe help affect ethical behavior change, right? Like we do.
That's about, again, going back to the normative claim thing. I think that's why ACT is the first thing from my point of view, that initially sounded woo-woo, but when I started reading about it a little bit, actually made sense to me from a behavioral point of view because of the way it interacts with values, because values are your narrative. Values are the ethos that you choose to live by and you ascribe towards, and you choose to project that image out into the world and exist in. And if your values are wrong or aren't really actually resonating with who you are intrinsically in and of yourself, mm-hmm. right? You're going to be in conflict with yourself, and you're never going to really be able to actualize the things that you want to achieve in your life. So yeah, I think that narrative is about sorting yourself out and getting your values straight and making sure that you tell your story, not just to other people, but to yourself, that in a way that makes sense and is consistent with who you want to be. And is that empirical? I don't know. I think it's how one ought to live.
Dude, it's like worked for me in so many great ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question, man. Literally, this is the question Socrates asked. This is the first great question. How ought one to live is the entire examination of philosophy. That's the question. It's addressed by Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics. It's addressed by Marcus Aurelius in the Meditations. It's addressed by Descartes. It's addressed by Nietzsche. It's every single great philosopher trying to tackle the question of how ought one to live. And it's about sorting out your values and in actualizing who you are and living your truth, you know? And that's where narrative comes into play. And there's that new thing that's been out. Well, I don't know if it's new, but a lot of self-help gurus or whatever point to this thing called being the hero of your own story, right? You want to achieve something great, or if you want to get a goal done, you know, you sit down and you write out who you are, where your starting point, where you want to be and what you need to do to get there. And you place yourself in the context of good and evil, man. And you live that, you wrestle the dragon. And be the hero of your story. So yeah, narrative is absolutely essential to that. And I think there's not enough discussion on the poetry of it. I think if you're like, even from, I've had this problem in my own life, that when you get too caught up in the hardcore empiricism and the hardcore scientific point of view and borderline objectivism, where if you can't feel it and if you can't see it and touch it, it's irrelevant, you know, you lose sight of the poetry of life, man. And narrative dresses that up and adds a little poetry to living. So,
yeah, you reminded me when you said that of when I was in grad school and it just finished and we were starting up the center down there in Florida. All I did always was just read our field's literature. That was it, dude. Like, I either did that, I talked about it, I drank beers talking about it, I worked in the fish lab, we worked with pigeons, we went to work. That was it. That was it. I literally like was in school with somebody that was at that time like a year below me. So I was helping in that sort of capacity. I would run like the study sessions for a cohort with a couple folks when people needed help. I was doing online tutoring in that sort of regard. The fish lab was literally attached as a mother-in-law suite to our house. Like there was no separation of anything whatsoever. It's like blank. Like I learned shit during that period of time that like stays with me. But I like that was like just a dark ages time where I don't remember enjoying a lot of anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, think of a movie, man. That was a montage. The montage in every movie is where all the hard work happens. But it's always, if you were to play it in real time, is the horrible, sweaty,
boring as hell,
shit, boring, kill yourself time where the hero is transforming themselves into from the weakling that they once were to the power.
Let's talk about this. Why do you think people don't want to do that sort of shit? So like we were talking about before we hit record on here that it may be fun to go through and look at some of the forums and what's being talked about and kind of provide some discussion around those sort of things. One that I had seen is people saying that it maybe makes them uncomfortable or that they're not as a fortunate of a situation to where that they can, spend all the time reading all these books because they have other competing things or they don't have the cash or whatever it is. What's your thoughts on that, man? Like,
I mean, I have a gentle version of that and I have a hard version of that. I mean, the gentle version is that life is hard and imperfect and, you know, people reach out for help and if they can get it, they can. The harsh version of it is that behaviorally speaking, people will engage in the least amount of effort to access the maximal amount of reinforcement. And if the internet is to provide you answers, then why bother putting in the effort? I think what separates people like, I don't know, people, not to sound like an arrogant dick, but I mean, like somebody like you and me who can just sit down and bullshit for 2 hours about nonsense, you know,
yeah,
and actually sound semi-cogent, is that we have one point in our lives embraced the suck.
Yeah. See, and to me, I was literally told by one of my best colleagues that you go to graduate school and you assume it's a prison sentence. You're not going to enjoy your time. You're going in and you're learning as much as you possibly can on everybody else's rules. And like, you will come out of it and you will rebuild your life. And I get that people will go into those sort of things with different situations, but like, are like with different, everybody comes in there with a different history and with different expectations and like different programs will share that sort of stuff. That's not how it was articulated to me by my program, to be very clear there. That was not coming from any academic advisor. That was coming from a colleague that had been in a program and been around a lot of people in programs like that before. But man, like, I mean, I know for me, like I was told what you do is part of to marry it back to the narrative part. Like I was told these stories of, if you want to be very good, you consume everything you possibly can about this field in so many different ways. You're going to find a niche probably at some point, you're going to consume more there, but consume as much as you can about everybody out there. So I agree.
I think that's also people not actually living their passion. So I don't know if I agree with that completely.
Really?
Like, yeah. Cause I think again, dude, I mean, if you, this is the, so let's flip from normative to descriptive. I mean, this, let's actually be analytic. You know, why do people not engage in particular kinds of behaviors? Because the MOs aren't in place.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
That applies,
man,
to everything, right? So if you, or if you don't,
or it's a lack of resources and like the SDs aren't there.
I mean, but sure.
I think those those things have gotten a lot easier. Like, you can go fucking torrent a book right now, and most books in behavior analysis that are textbooks too.
That's why, like, I hear you on the resources thing, and yes, of course, like, not everyone has the same opportunities, et cetera. Okay, fine. But all things being equal, all right, and from a scientific, from a behavioral point of view,
yeah,
the real reason someone wouldn't engage in a particular behavioral response is because they are not adequately deprived or satiated or have the particular MO acting upon them in that particular instance, period.
You know, the one that I agree with you there, the one that I found most interesting was when people would state that they value it and they want to do it, and then the SD's there, but then behavior doesn't occur, man. You know what I mean?
I mean, that's the difference. That's just full of shititude, bro. I mean, right? there is such a thing as being full of shit,
and
we don't have an empty supply of it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I think part of it, I wonder how much of it is like kind of issues with contacting the delayed reinforcers and like the delayed discounting component there, right?
I
don't benefit from some of the best books I've ever read because of what they gave me the next day to work with. I benefited with them because I had that knowledge when I was looking at everything else in the field. Like,
of course.
Like, Gold Diamond's Blue Books that you've been reading.
Just sidebar real quick before you go finish your thought. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but those, like, all due respect to Cooper Heron and Heward, that book is an absolutely wonderful introductory textbook. The Blue Books from Adronis, Gold Diamond, and Thomas, I think, is the guy. Dude, this thing is a mother effing masterpiece.
Yeah,
it's all. I mean, like, and not only that, but I'm reading it as somebody with 10 years experience, and I feel like I'm learning. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And like, it's teaching point of view too. It's not just giving. It's unbelievable. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
He integrated the philosophy throughout, man. Like,
it's so, I mean, he actually talks about philosophy. He quotes Aristotle, man. Yeah. Like, are you kidding me? Like, a behavior textbook that quotes Aristotle. Like, so, come on. So, be still my beating heart, man.
Some context for people. The Blue Books were named that because they were bound in this blue binding. My understanding of all this was that Israel Gold Diamond, who's at the University of Chicago, he was writing his own books, just like Science and Human Behavior was a course, like a book, a textbook that he used for a course that Skinner wrote. The same for here with Israel Gold Diamond. And the... Sorry, I gotta mute my phone.
You're good. My Audacity file, I forgot to turn it on, so it's starting now, so we're gonna have to pull some audio from the fucking...
Okay.
Sorry.
So the Blue Books were that compilation. They were never finished, actually. So he writes, he wrote them. They were in paper, print copies, wherever, from his students that had them. They turned them into like an EPUB, or sorry, an ebook for, or no, like a PDF, kind of linked PDF.
Interactive PDF.
Yeah, there we go.
Intentionally, actually.
Yeah.
As a tribute to him.
And it was put out there on the Cambridge Center's website. You can actually go up there. You can pay like $12.95 or something like that. Get a Dropbox link, download them. I'm sure they're online too. Don't tell the Cambridge Center, but like, you can probably find them online somewhere. The $13 is really a barrier. Like, go read them.
990 pages of magic.
Yes. And the thing that just drove me nuts was that they were so well written. They were so amazing. And he wrote out a table of contents that he did not finish.
Yeah, I haven't gotten that far yet.
Come on. I always tell Joe Lang and Paul Andronis, like, you guys got to finish these, you know? Like, you got to polish these off.
Dude. They're a goddamn masterpiece. It's something I wish I had 10 years ago.
And the same thing. Like, I used to get pissed at people when they'd show me resources like that. I'm like, where has this been my whole freaking career?
How has no one ever referred to it in any class, any fucking conference, nothing? Like, it's so good.
Let's shift
back
to that.
To narrative, if you don't mind.
Let's shift to that, man. I think that's relevant. Like, the narrative of behavior analysis is controlled by people that write it down in certain ways. Like, the fact that Izzy had negative interactions. I heard he was very abrasive with the behavioral community oftentimes, probably led to part of it not being included. It was different in thinking. So for some context for listeners, the ABC model was not a thing that he includes. He would completely shit all over that, actually. And he includes something that's much more comprehensive. There are more variables, which most people go, oh, it's more complex. There's more to learn. But he has some of the most beautiful lines in there, man, where he talks about how
it's outstanding.
He's like, you can approach the world and assuming that it is simple. You approach the world and you assume that it's a simple world, then it's going to appear very complex when you're trying to understand it. But if you approach it with the assumption that it's a very complex world, then you can understand all the relations involved and it becomes a very simple thing to understand.
Absolutely.
And that's where I loved like the way in which you approach these things, man, the framework in which you and your mindset of how you're going into there and understanding them is so key, man. And I don't know. My hunch is that it was a mixture of his abrasiveness with the behavioral community mixed with not a lot of students, not a lot of people believing in this sort of view. So I remember distinctly asking Steve Hayes in 2014 or 15, can't remember exactly when it was, either fall or spring of those years. And I said, what about Gold Diamond's like constructional approach? And he's like, there's no empirical line, man. Like it didn't really take off. And I was like, well, the only thought I have to that is if you don't have enough people, you can't really test that out. So you can't, you know, say there's not the empirical line there of that thought kind of going forward if you didn't actually try to sufficiently test it out. And I look at things like Headsprout and the 3 million kids that have taught to read as evidence for that line of thinking. You know, like it doesn't have to be in an empirical study, but like that.
I feel like I'm reading proto-contextualism, dude.
Proto-contextualism. Like, break that down for someone like me.
Well, I just feel like it's setting the stage for what now we would consider contextual behavior science.
Okay,
but
yeah.
It's trying to articulate it in the similar, not quite reductionistic way, but in that much more clearly descriptive scientific language that you would see in a conventional behavior analytic framework.
Okay. Yeah, so the other reason I think that it wasn't kind of... So that's a couple reasons. Like, I heard that Gold Diamond was abrasive, to put it nicely, is what I've been told. I've heard that the empirical lines haven't taken off. But we know another thing is, like with our certification exam, if it's not popular, it's not going to be voted as like something that needs to be onto there. So I can see why people don't include it, but I would have to double check, but I don't think it's referenced at all in the white book or behavior. The other one, the behavior.
Until you showed it to me, dude, I had never heard of it. And I read a good amount.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And I had never heard of this shit.
We're going to have to definitely release this next month because I have a poster coming out with Israel Gold Diamond that they're working on.
Awesome.
On the website. So to kind of commemorate and honor his work. So,
dude, I am just so blown away and it's just so good. Mostly because I appreciate the attention to underlying the philosophy. There's this great John Kimball article called Philosophy Matters that he wrote. And what's great about that article is that he dude, it's a great article, right?
Yeah.
And what's cool about it is that he lays out this beautiful framework where he shows how the intermingling between philosophy and experimental science versus applied science versus
the actual practice,
the technology and actual practice and technologies that emerge from it. And he makes a couple different analogies. He gives you a behavior analytic view of that where it's like, you know, Skinner about behaviorism type thing. And then you have EAB and then ABA and then whatever technological packages emerge from that. But then physics and engineering and those types of other analogies to other sciences. And this starts from the beginning. It blends. It begins with philosophy, and it moves into the EAB type framework. Then it moves into an applied point of view, and it follows this wonderful natural flow of really pulling people out of the behavioral matrix, man. I swear to because I mean we're so plugged in. Well, I mean we were talking about before. We're so plugged in to that rigid interventionist autism bubble, you know. That where all of our practice, all of our research lines are kind of tied to that singular population. So they're contextually kind of framed in that way. And this divorces that and puts it right back into what probably Skinner would have done, which was, and he did do in all of his books, which was frame it from a broader behavioral perspective and then pared it down from there without necessarily tying it to a particular context or population or necessary output of people, just general principles. So yeah. It was just really, it's just been a really awesome experience to go through it. And I actually got a study group going with a friend of mine where we're meeting once a week and we're kind of attacking it a little bit at a time because nice. It's almost 1,000 pages and it's technical. So
it's a tome, man.
You know what I mean? It's not for the faint of heart. It's a journey, but I'm going to slay that dragon for sure.
Yeah, dude, he destroys prompting and like the point of prompting at the end of that in a big ass section. It's great, dude. Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Fantastic.
I'm glad that you're digging those, man. Did Jonathan Kimball give you that article when we were out there for that your y'all's conference?
Well, I shook his hand, but I didn't really spend any time with him. Dr. Hoglund actually turned me on to him, man.
Okay.
Dr. H is like my Yoda, man. That dude, like, he's so sneaky smart. Like, you know, he doesn't talk a lot about behavior stuff, but he'll just slide, hey, you should read this. Or he'll talk about something and I'll pick it up and be like, how the fuck have I never heard of this?
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Those are my favorite people, man. They're the ones that usually aren't on social media, right?
Exactly.
They're at the bar. They're not going to toxic conferences. They're the ones that have like 35-year member or like 45-year member.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Those are my people too, dude. Someone was critiquing ABI and like not going out because the cost and how expensive it was. And I was like, you know, as long as folks keep showing up with those 25-plus-year badges, like I'm going to keep going because that I can tell you every single event I've been to, no matter how much the cost was in those sort of contexts, like it always, I can tell you each ABI, like who I met and how that informed like the trajectory of what I got going on. I think it's just kind of a lack of being able to connect with the right people at those events that starts to push people away. Anyhow, that's a different thing. But yeah, man, Jonathan Kimball, that article he gave to me when we were out there for your event, he would have invited me over to go have a drink real quick. And Jonathan was there and he said, you got to read this chapter. Or whatever. It's not even a chapter. It's just like a short article and like a...
Yeah, it's a conceptual piece, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good.
It was good, man. He wrote into it recently. I doubt he'll listen to this, but you hear this, Jonathan. What up, man? He wrote in.
Yeah, shout out Jonathan Kimball.
He liked the Pat Fryman video that was going around. So I'm going to catch him at ABI again. There's kind of full circle. That's why you go to ABI, because you can catch these folks like that at these events.
Oh, dude. Yeah, they crush... Well, I mean, there's not a lot. I think our field is getting bigger, but it's still kind of small enough to where if you have the courage to just step out of your zone and reach out to somebody, you actually they might respond for real, you know. And if you're willing to read and expand your horizons, and
exactly,
you know, and that's just about getting out of your comfort zone a little bit, which I think is pretty important.
Yeah, someone was asking me the other day, like, how do you go about doing those sort of things? Like a good example is like how I got off a call with Randy Olson. Like I read his book like a month ago and like you just talked to the author. You got to show people that you've put in the work, man. And like, that is the first step. And there's no different in our field. It's not that hard to me. Like the recipes, like learn and have something meaningful and try to catch them with a different hook. Right.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I also think that it's about, coming back to narrative, I think it has to do with deciding what you want, ascribing to that values line and seeing it through to its inevitable conclusion fearlessly. You know what I mean? Like there's something about that creates the opportunity that you're talking about, because even if you could, I mean, I can think of two or three people who are bigger bookworms than I am. And they are just some of the most well-read people I've ever met in my life, but they would never reach out to somebody like that and try to talk to them or actually step out of their comfort zone just because it's not their personality. It's not who they are. It's not what they're into.
Yeah.
But you know, so knowledge is important, but I think also the willingness to just say, okay, this is what you want. This is what you go get it. You know what I mean? That's really it. That's more important, I think, and more feasible than what you mentioned before. Yeah, because it's pretty cool that we have these types of people available to us. It's pretty amazing. Like, we're going to have, you know, Carl's going to be talking to us, which is amazing. Yeah. And, like, Carl Biner, one of Skinner's last students, like, this guy that is just, you know, an unbelievable legend of our field. OBM master extraordinaire and just like big effing deal, you know? And he's willing to sit down and just bullshit with us for a couple hours. Like, who the fuck are we? Like, what have we done in our lives?
Yeah.
You know, pretty accomplished person. Or even when Rick came on, Rick's pretty freaking accomplished to be willing to do that. So, and a lot of it just has to do with the willingness to get out there and put ourselves out there and see if they'd reach out and do and play with us a little bit.
Yeah. There's also,
so it's cool like that.
There's more awareness to, especially with those two guys, of like the role of new media. And like, and I air quotes, like podcast videos and those things helping them out.
Yeah, that's true. They are a lot more sensitive to it. And in all fairness, you've done so much work now at this point. You've got enough of a body where you have your own celebrity going on, which is cool. But I mean, well, even so though, I just mean like, as far as like contributing experimentally, I mean,
no. I agree, totally. Like, yeah.
You know, substantively the science itself. It's a different ball game.
Yeah,
and like, Carl, I mean, how much is Carl written? Jesus, a ton.
Yeah, no, and I hold those two up on like a much higher pedestal than myself any day because of the work and tenacity they put in at those different levels, man. Like, that's much harder to operate at that level than making a damn video.
Do you ever see yourself changing gears and going down that road?
So my thought on research in academia, first point is I almost jumped into a PhD program right after we started up a center in Florida. I had a couple different options. One offered to me as like a full ride, and I was like, nah, I'm good. It wasn't the right situation with the right people. The other one, and the thing is, I kind of feel like I escaped a dodged a bullet there. Second was, I applied for Steve Hayes' lab, and I just told the guy, like, I'm not doing the psych GRE. That doesn't sound fun. If I applied, do you think I'd still get in? He's like, if your application is strong enough, sure. And so when I got denied on that, I was like, okay, cool. And that's when I started getting much more into business entrepreneurship. And I realized like that is much more fun. So, academia, like, and that sort of like student work, like you're doing, man, I don't know how y'all do that. I'm done. That organized education, it's not for me. The research I value, man, like that is our bread and butter. That's our backbone. Like that's what we have to have. So, for me, man, I really looked after Ogden Lindsley, and I looked up to him and how he approached it. He would fund research projects because of his entrepreneurship at the end of the day. He also had some inheritance or something like that. He had like a good chunk of cash back then that he used that I know he didn't hustle for, but I knew he hustled as well to be able to get his cash. And so I looked at that as like a third act of my career sort of thing, man, like what can I do to help fund research and like see the things out that I want to see out? If I can be successful in other areas.
Yeah. The doctorate is one of those things. It's kind of a means to an end for me, honestly. I don't know. I don't see myself in academia. That's definitely not the case. And mostly because I think it's toxic and counterproductive, and I find entrepreneurship more exciting.
Yeah,
I just think that the doctorate dipping your toe in that pool and doing some experimental work, I think increases your awareness of it and makes you appreciate it more. It forces you to ingest infinite amounts of information too, because you're graded on it. So I think for me, it's just an external force applying pressure on me to do some work that maybe on my own I would be skipping, because I have a tendency to read what I want to read, not what I have to read.
And that's why
I need to read, you know?
That's why I did a thesis track master's program where I had to do something that was applied. Like, I did an applied research study. That thing took 9 months. The process was just grueling. That's part of the reason.
That's what I'm in. I'm going through that right now, dude. IRB is the enemy.
Yeah.
I fucking hate them. They're the worst ever.
In a sense, it comes down to what role did I want to play in research, and I value it. So at that point, I also realized that I had weaknesses in a couple ways. Like, I didn't enjoy the day-to-day of a research study like that. I didn't enjoy the writing process, and I wasn't the best at the methods and the exact experimental controls that you had to have in place. And I could dedicate, you know, 5 or 10 years of my life to figure those sort of things out, I think, and be pretty good, or at least have a much better understanding where my skill set breaks down and when to call a friend. But for me, it was more so like, being interested in entrepreneurship, I might as well just leverage and like double down on that sort of stuff.
Oh, I think honestly, I think you're making the right decision. Again, like if I could go back now, hell, I'm already so knee deep into it. I'm getting this thing done. But I don't know if I was the person I am today, 14, 15 months ago, I don't know if I would be doing it.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, Bill Gates is a good example. 99.96% of his cash is going to be donated to some sort of cause at the end of the day. And like,
sure.
When I saw Ogden Lindsley and what I heard from him is that there was a lot of his personal funds were put into projects and research so that things could be figured out, discovered, and move forward. I know the Behavior Bank itself was worth, in today's cash, $1.6 million. That was an inheritance of some sort that was put onto that. There was not a research fund or a grant. It was Alex saying, I believe in this idea so much that I will put this much cash on trying to make this thing happen. And that is an absurd way to go about it. But for me, I was like, man, that would be cool. Because later in your life, you can figure out, okay, what do we really need to figure out? And funding was always the hardest thing, man. Like figuring out how to fund things. I feel like if I could wave a wand and I was like, Dimitri, just go study stuff for 10 years. You know how fucking cool that'd be?
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable.
You know what I mean?
yeah, man. So, creating an engine of, I think us sitting here doing the podcast, even like to me, this is an opportunity to create an engine of some kind that may in the future support what I want to do the way I want to do it.
Oh yeah.
And will this necessarily be the avenue? I don't know, but I think that looking at
will this get you towards that goal?
Entrepreneurship, yes. You know, developing some type of revenue generation that's diversified enough, I think is absolutely critical to doing what you need to do when you grow up, period. You know, and bringing it all back to narrative, I think the only way that you can get to the point where you can motivate yourself and maintain that over long periods of time is constructing an internal monologue and a story that you're working through that makes that horrible part of it, that grindy piece of it, something worth doing. You know,
yeah.
I noticed on your in your talk you had a picture of Goggins. What are you? Did you just reference him just randomly, or did you actually?
No,
what did
man.
You say about him?
So what I was talking about was, so this was different than the narrative workshop that I did, just to set the context for people. This was the talk, which was focusing on my personal story of why I found the chart and precision teaching valuable. And so listeners, if it's your first time, I value that thing on the back end. I don't think you need to shove it in people's faces, but I like parts of it. One of those big things was I was relating it to when you're trying to figure out where you're going, what you're trying to do in life. Video timed out. I should be better at this. Call myself a videographer sometimes. I can't even fucking make sure record's happening. When you're trying to figure out what's going on, you know, you have those like five simple steps, those articles that are like how to be the best person and that sort of shit. And they're just listicles trying to get you to click in. But for me, when I was young, like that's when stuff started getting thrown at me. Like I was in the early days of later days, like MySpace at its prime and its death. Facebook in its early days and those sort of things. You just start getting a bunch of shit thrown at you and you're trying to figure out what's going on. And what I liked about Goggins is Goggins talked about the montage episodes in detail like you were talking about. So
exactly,
montage. Most things are saying, this is where I was, this is where I want to be and where I'm going to go. And my graph, it was a perfect graph. So to paint it for people, it said where you are, where you want to be, for kind of like time on that axis. And then it said, you suck and then you don't suck anymore. And that was their Y axis. And it was just a graph going up on that. And what I talked about there was the reason I like Goggins so much is most people on those success stories, it's either they don't have time to communicate it necessarily, or they're misinterpreted for the work that's gone into there, or people just don't know what it is. But most of those listicles take out the actual transition state, like where you're learning and where you're working really hard, and they just say, here's how you get to there. And it's like maybe one of those might be like you set your alarm at 4:30 in the morning and you wake up on the first alarm clock. Okay, cool. That's not gonna get me anywhere, man. Like that's not how I'm gonna move forward in life. Like it's not that one thing. It is. That is a crucial step, perhaps, to somebody's self-management routine, yes. But that is not the only thing that it's going to be. And not to throw out, like, Jocko from my understanding of that book, it's still queued up, but I've seen some things done on it. Him talking.
I've read it. Extreme Ownership. I've read it.
Yeah. Okay. It's a little more holistic than that, right? Like that's not as.
Oh, Extreme Ownership is definitely more holistic than that for sure. It's pretty cool if you're into war stories and stuff. It's a compilation of him describing some of the him as a Navy SEAL in the Battle of Ramadi. And then tying it back into the idea of crisis management with limited resources without while maintaining composure and doing that through the practice of extreme ownership, which is what do I need to do to get it done and taking accountability and responsibility cool. for everything around you.
Yeah, sweet. Okay, I'm going to love that book.
Yeah, it's a great book. So it's unbelievable book.
What I really like about David Goggins is he talks about that same stuff. Like it is the meat and the bones of like how you got from one to the next. People don't, you know, people...
Did you read his book too? Can't Hurt Me?
I'm starting it. I'm like halfway through.
It's so powerful. I literally was crying.
Yeah, dude.
I literally broke down into tears. The opening chapters where he's talking about his childhood, it reduced me to tears. Mostly because I was like reliving my own childhood in different instances. But dude, his story, his narrative, his strength, it's just
his balls to go on record of all that
the
stuff,
man
too.
The man has transcended humanity, bro.
So people haven't stopped this to go Google him or don't know anything about him. The guy went from, you know, 300 or 350 pounds overweight, working a dead end job, as he described it, his words and those sort of things, to
literally
like,
a cockroach exterminator.
Yes. to signing up for a 100-mile 24-hour race and completing it in 19 hours without ever running a marathon in his life, to the point that he was carried by his wife, bleeding from his ass, and just like sitting in a tub, like falling apart as a human being, but loving the fact that he figured out how to run 100 miles and push his body to that far of an extreme. So he's known for pushing his body to absolute extremes. He realized along the way just how you can destroy and hurt yourself and like how you got to go about like good regimens and stuff like that. But the thing with him is he wanted to show that you could push your body far beyond what you ever thought was potentially
Yeah, he's
possible.
Got this thing called the 40% rule, which again, I honestly don't know if I could do that shit, but like he's like, whenever you think you're about to collapse, you're only at 40%. It's like, whoa. And this he's had the world pull-up record. He's a champion ultra marathoner. He's the only person to do Navy SEAL, Army Ranger, and one other special operations classification in the military history.
Yeah.
The guy's a superhuman, and he got into the Navy SEALs and into the Navy from being 350 pounds, 300 pounds overweight, and a cockroach exterminator, and just said, fuck this.
Yeah.
It just changed his stars, man.
So to bring it back in behavior analysis, like I liked that he I like that he and Jocko and those people acknowledge those transition states. Like you have to get from one place to the next. And that's what our field's about, man. We're about individual success, how to measure those sort of things.
Exactly.
I honestly think that a lot of these big movements, a lot of these big motivational speakers, I'm using that in air quotes also because I know some of those guys don't like to be labeled that.
Whatever.
What they want to do is they want to figure out how to understand this even better. So like marrying those folks with our field, I think would be amazing, man. It might be
or have people from our field do that. Like I think Pat Fryman is the closest thing as far as like when he speaks to tapping into that kind of like visceral response, call and response with the crowd because he understands those things.
Yeah.
And the hardcore empiricists just don't have the social skills, don't have the speaking, the understanding of crowd control and crowd engagement to be able to do the narrative stuff that you're talking about and weaving things into a story.
I just want to tell folks, like, I don't want to discredit in my own personal adventures of this sort of stuff, like the importance of those sort of people. We all got to work
together. Of course. No.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Definitely not doing that.
We all have to work together. I know.
I mean, it's a $2 billion. I mean, the self-help industry is a $2 billion industry, and we're all competing for the same clients. Yeah. When we could be competing for our client list should be infinitely possible because as long as there's human beings, we should have possible clients.
Exactly.
And if anyone should be working on self-help or self-improvement, it should be people who exercise the science of behavior change,
so,
not some guru who came up with 5 steps to success.
So I've got
it's absolutely ludicrous.
I've got a story for you that's kind of relevant. In 2000 and 11, 12, Mark Malady and I found this group called Quantified Self. And the idea was that you were trying to just create a place, a community where people were just trying to figure out what sensors could measure the behavior that I'm interested in, whether that's biological behavior, whatever. Really cool group, quantifiedself.com. And we watched them. We would read. There was a lot of bio sort of stuff. So there was a lot of people really digging the bio level and like, well, how did that influence? But people were literally using like this kind of like jank approach to single subject methodology to understand what was going on in their life. And it was like crazy stuff. Like people would literally be like, hey, I realized how to prove that I actually do have cancer to my to my MD, and it saved my life. Like it was shit like that where they showed with sensors and like their ability to go in and just like science how to prove to people some really cool, crazy shit. And it was a community that was critiquing, but very warming at the same time, right? Like they welcome and bring people in, but they'd really critique and like make sure they're doing some cool stuff. Ran their own conferences and shit. I ended up going to start one of their chapters in Reno. Didn't get it sustainably going for longer than about 6 or 9 months. It was hard to find a critical mass. I now know how to find people a lot easier and like make those sort of things work, I think, a little bit better. But I ended up submitting to present at their conference in this like roundtable discussion about the role of behavior analysis and self-management in single case design. Again, really rudimentary on my skill set of communicating to people outside of our field, and like it's getting better because of me flopping in situations like that. But what was most fascinating to me is there was an online group I was a part of. I still am. I kind of talked to them back and forth in like a Slack group, and I was talking about behavior analysis being my like worldview. And the leader of that was so against behavior analysis, man, that I got the hammer thrown down on me, like in their form.
He banned you?
Huh?
He banned you?
He did not ban me, but he basically said like, we don't believe in that stuff here, essentially.
What? Did he give you any more information?
He had a really rudimentary, like most people have, a view of behavior analysis, and he didn't understand the comprehensive contextual part of it. So it was me not really being tactful and not noticing those sort of things early on and altering my approach that caused the problem, but kind of full circle, man. So there was, I don't remember the exact interaction, but they invited someone to come out. I can't remember who it was. If it was Nurenture, if it was Heinlein, it might've been Heinlein. They invited somebody to come out to their conference and speak. So when I saw that, I kind of like chimed back in with a much softer message. Like, hey, I know that guy. And I was like, it's that behavior analysis stuff. And the guy replied saying, yeah, he's going to go out to Chicago and go to ABI this year because Heinlein kind of like changes his view.
Oh, wow. That's good.
And why did we even bring up quantified self? Do you remember?
Dude, I don't know. This is fun. This is the whole point of podcasting, well, bro. You just fucking go down the rabbit hole and you just ride that wave till it's over. Just go. Don't think, talk.
Yeah. I was going to try to bring it back
around.
Stream
of consciousness, my man.
Right? But I don't know. I guess, I lost my main point, but dude, you never know when things are going to circle back around. I really hope to have like buy that guy a beer and be like, hey, man, I'm sorry I was that asshole of a behavior analyst back then. And I'd love to be a part of more of their organization, what they're doing again. I told so many behavior analysts, like, go to this event. Oh, that's what it was. Dude, so when I went to the first event, their opening keynote was talking about how they needed to have a framework to understand how to approach researching with an N of one. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
We got that, buddy.
And this was before I was like banned from, or not banned, but this is before I got the hammer thrown down on me. And like, I was just like, you guys need to read Sidman's Tactics of Scientific Research. Like, we have what you guys are looking for. And the whole point of like, I don't know, I don't want to live by goals that I can't necessarily control. But I don't mind behaving in the direction of them. And one of those is like, dude, if I could figure out how to get some of the right people at the right table, these guys are all Silicon Valley dudes. They're doing really cool shit, man. Like they are moving human behavior in ways that our field wish we could, but they don't have the measurement system and our field.
Yeah,
has
they have
that.
The money though.
Yeah. But they're the missing component maybe in a way.
Yeah.
The marriage of those two different fields would be really good. I'm glad that I figured out that connection. That shit drives me nuts, dude.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
So, yeah, man, quantified self, dude. If anyone wants...
Yeah, I can't remember. I checked that out, actually. I think maybe it was on your recommendation. Or maybe it was on Mark's.
I've linked it a few times. I put up a self-management project on consuming behavior analytic articles that's sure. still linked on their site.
What is your self? What is your self management routine? Do you have a routine, or are you just kind of like fucking go all the time?
So, it was really solid for a while, but I've had to change it. So, first thing is it's always evolving. It's dynamic. It's never a static thing. Like if anybody's listening and expects you to have a static thing, maybe some people that fits, but for me, it just doesn't work. What I've had to move into was something that is like you have different types of days in which you do different types of things. And so it's kind of this algorithm of what type of day is this? Is this a content creation day? Is this a catch up on email day? Is this I was just gone for 2 weeks sort of week? You know, like there's different things like that that I'm figuring out. Dude, it used to be, though, alarm was set for 4:30. I was out of the house at the gym 4:45 to 5 at the latest. I was into work at like 7:30. Or 8, I crushed out my work day, and then I'd work on stuff until about 11 o'clock, and then it was 11 to 11:45 p.m. was my time to kind of like consume whatever, and then I'd pass out. It was 5 hours. I was back up. I was tired every day when I went to bed. I was tired when I woke up, but for me, caffeine, the right balance and all that was able to keep me going on that, but that was rattled when I met my now girlfriend, and like that sort of changed things in a really good way. So like that isn't sustainable for a lifetime necessarily.
Just wait till you get fat for a little bit.
So
happy equals chub.
Well, dude, for me, like that's so for self-management, man, like you got to look in different domains of your life. Like, what are the different domains? So family versus professional versus your personal relationships, your colleagues, your friendships, or whatever it is that you have. Like, for me, I looked at how am I behaving towards these sort of things? How did I do the last week? And what was that like? If I realized, whoa, like I used to do this thing and I still do it in the shower, where I'd think about like real quick in those domains, like how have I performed in the last week? When I think of something... So for example, like this morning I was thinking about like, when is the last time that I had like seen my sister and like been over and like seen her? Like when you can't tact or identify when that last was, like you probably have a problem there when it comes to your self-management based on your values and like where you rank that sort of stuff. Yeah. So for me, man, it was like twofold. It was like identify when things are going well and when you need to collect more data. As you collect more data in your life, you start to have a better framework for how are those level trends and variability in your data sets going, I think. But then the whole other side of it is conceptualizing what's going on and like how to attack it, which that's hard, dude. I don't know. What's yours first before we get into how to analyze problems in your self-management, what's your routine?
Mine is pretty, it's pretty rigid actually. I mean, my workout routine is P90X because it's automatic, it's easy, and I don't have to go anywhere. I used to play disc golf all the time, but I just don't. That's not enough exercise, and I can't. And I've found that for me to avoid any type of anxiety or depression, I need to exercise at least 60 minutes a day. That is an absolute non-negotiable. So for me, it's more like I have my non-negotiables and I have my negotiables. And then my non-negotiables are 60 minutes a day of exercise and then at least an hour of just me time, period. So it's 2 hours a day that I will not sacrifice no matter what. Everything cool. else is scheduled to the point of how much time I'll spend with my wife. And she, if she hears this, she'll not know that, but she knows it now. But I mean and I really try to do that. And honestly, I really do kind of, I'm a little bit more, I force myself to get obsessed, man. I have an addictive personality. Predilection. I can't believe I just said that. I'm a behavior analyst, said I have addictive personality, but I mean, like for real, I have a tendency to get incredibly obsessed with things and just pursue them in a way that is probably not healthy. Right now, it just so happens to be my doctoral work and this podcast and my actual work, so it fits all is gelling together. But I had to overcome a lot of things in self-management to get to this point. I mean, I definitely had a video game addiction at one point that was out of control that I had to interrupt and troubleshoot. So if you want to talk about troubleshooting, I feel like breaking routines and getting out of ruts. I mean, I've had a lot of bouts of depression through the years, or a lot of different instances where I was just not necessarily self-destructive, but not engaging in reasonably productive behavior that fed my soul in a way that mattered, you know? And, dude, yeah, any of those video game TV shows or documentaries you would watch of people that are addicted to games. I mean, I got 11,000 hours in a single game. That's like 480 full 24-hour periods. That's a part of my life I'll never get back. It's gone, you know? And like, the thing about those types of games is they're socially mediated, they're community oriented, they're incredible. I mean, they're casino level addicting.
That's about 4.5 years of your job time for anybody like trying to think back
on. Dude, it was fucking nuts. Like,
what was the game?
Elder Scrolls Online.
Nice.
Yes,
into first person shooters, particularly Modern Warfare 2 when that came out. Oh my gosh, dude, I would wake up 16,000th in the world and I would go to bed when I was in the top 10.
Yeah, and that's what I got addicted to, the competitive piece of it. Yeah. Because I'm such a competitive person.
Same,
so like,
dude.
I'd be like, weekly leaderboards, baby. Got to get in the top 100, North American server.
Dude,
let's go.
I work
and it's just
so
like sickness,
hard.
Man.
Yeah.
And
so
it's like,
hard.
What am I doing? If I read and worked harder on like stuff that mattered, I would like that amount of time. Like they say it takes 10,000 hours to master a skill. I could have been a master violinist in the amount of time I dedicated to that fucking game, or like just something. I could have like gotten a doctorate, shit, like, you know.
Yeah.
And then I was like, wait a second, you should go do that instead of this bullshit.
Yeah.
So I actually did what I do with my kids or in my work. I did an environmental assessment.
Yeah.
I was like, this shit's got to go. I constructed a whole different setup and I increased the response effort so unbelievably to get that shit to play my game to the point where I even went in and sabotaged it to where it's almost unplayable because I don't have all the shit that I need to do what I need to do inside of the game.
Yeah.
That it's now almost repulsive to me.
Yeah.
And I've turned it into a totally different thing.
There's that Skinner quote that's something to the effect of like, the self is only valuable when it's becomes valuable to everybody else or something like that.
Exactly.
And so for self-management, I've always thought of it has a component of the social people around you and who's around you to help you out as well. And I think there's two levels of that. There's the people immediately around you, but there's also I'm about to do this, that book I mentioned that I'm reading, like Great Artists Steal by whoever. I'll link in the show notes too. They said like, they do whatever you need to, like frame the people that you want to be emulating and put them in front of your desk so that you're looking at them, right? Like there's so many ways to go about it, but the community, the people around you are also the ones that you need to be focusing on there. So for me, like I have always had people in my life that I trust immensely with giving me feedback on like, yo, dude, you need to chill out. For me with video games, it was my roommate at the time, he was like, hey, school starts tomorrow. And I was like, yeah, right, dude. Like, we got a few more weeks in winter break. And he's like, no, like, school's tomorrow. Are you ready? And I was like, are you shitting me? Like, I just played this game. You time traveled. Dude, for five weeks, all I did.
Yeah, you got an emotional DeLorean and you were fucking gone. Yeah.
Dude, that's all I did is I woke up and I was like, I would play until about 4 a.m. I'd sleep 2 hours. I'd go to work. I'd come back and I would play for 12 or 14 hours. And I would work as hard as I could to get up to there before I passed out. And
I can't believe my wife is still here.
Like, what I
left. Like it's something I'm so lucky. It's unbelievable. Like
what I had to do is I handed over my console to my roommate and I said, put this in your room. And like, I'm not allowed to have it for the rest of the semester.
Yeah.
I opened that thing once, one summer in between my first and second year of grad school. And I kind of slipped into it for a weekend and I came back out of that and I was like, that's it. And I took that thing and I dropped it in the trash, dude.
Dude, digital crack. It's digital crack. That's literally what I call it. That fucking game is particular is digital crack. And back, the one thing to say about your environmental piece, that's why my basement, like if people see my ridiculous stuff, I mean, all the artwork, my wife made all the, automated all the artwork for me because she knows I love comic books. But the reason I like it so much or I'm surrounded by it is because I really love the Jungian idea of archetypes and how the narratives feed what you need to operate throughout your day. I mean, being surrounded by my favorite superhero symbols and being surrounded by these things that symbolize like emerging as a new powerful entity of your own volition. You know what I mean? Just from the sheer force of will and willingness to engage the process, you know, inspires me, and it helps keep me in this really good positive framework that keeps me focused, helps me continue to execute, and they're ongoing and continuous SDs to keep my head down and grind and not feel, you know, not and trust the process, you know, like we were talking about comic books before with Rick, you know, like that's why I love like the Green Lantern and stuff, and I follow those stories because his superpower is the power of will, you know. I love that stuff, and I feed that narrative, man.
Yeah,
like it's just like you have to enrich your environment in that way. And if it's cheesy, fuck it. Like I even have like on my ceiling here, I have like plastered all these different, this probably somebody would come in here and they'd be like, beautiful mind, schizophrenic, crazy. But like, it's like I have all these pages ripped out with different like titles of papers or books, ideas, or just like concepts that I'd love to explore one day. And I just like plastering my ideas everywhere around me because your words feed you, your space feeds you, man.
For sure.
It changes the way you operate.
Yeah, dude. So like I'm inspired now to like go and create a video on this. I think I'm going to, maybe even today. I've kept every denial letter like that was of significance to me.
Oh, I love that shit. And I love that.
I printed them out, dude, from the Nevada ABA Association saying like, no, you're not going to be able to film in here. We want to like figure out a way to do this more systemically and that never working. That's okay to be told no. That's cool. But like Absolutely. That was something that I kept. ABI, I've got some stuff from them on the Saba Awards. They were saying like, sorry, like your efforts are cool, but we don't think that you're doing the best work when it comes to dissemination or whatever. And like, that's cool. Whatever. Cool. I'm printing that on, putting my fucking wall too. I've got those sort of things hung up, but I also have other shit that keeps me going. Like back here, I've got a picture signed by one of my favorite YouTube creators. I've got his hot, I've got a different one's coffee line. I've got, what else, dude? I want to go to New Zealand. My dad went and I was so jealous I couldn't go. And he brought me back a box of whiskey. And I told myself, I'm not going to open that until I create the perfect conditions and rules under which I'm allowed to open it.
Which exactly.
One of those is I'm not going to come back and open that thing of whiskey until I've gone to New Zealand and I come back. Like,
that's cool.
Like, but that's it, dude. Like, that's, I think that's absurd for some people, but like I've got goals to getting on top of giant peaks in the middle of the US and all over the fucking place. And I keep, I bought a 6-pack of beers. I wrote the peaks that I wanted to get on top of. And I put all those things on my mantle above my head dresser. And I've knocked 3 of the 6 of those out. That is going to be the nastiest beer when I get on top of that final one. But I will enjoy that son of a bitch, man. It's going to taste so good. Right?
I love that shit, man. That's awesome.
And it's sitting up in my house, like this beer that says, you know, Mount Shasta next to a crushed can with like the backpacking tag of the other ones I've been on.
That's awesome.
But it's like, it's setting up your environment, man, is a big part of it. But tying it in, like you're saying, like your narrative and like what it is that you want to be. For me then, dude, it's just a matter of logistics. Like, how do you do what when? Nothing's going to go as planned necessarily, but you'll get better and better and better at getting there. And you just keep setting those goals, keep setting those plans, man.
Do you have any mantras you like to repeat to yourself or any quotes that you like anchor yourself to if you're spiraling? Because I definitely have these moments where like, especially like self-doubt, imposter syndrome, just all that stuff creeps in because it's like you just, I mean, especially you get criticism online or even just at work or life in general. And like you just have those moments of weakness where you just trying to gather yourself, and it's like, how, what, do you have any language that you use to snap yourself back out of it?
I mean, I've got a few things. Like, nothing's gonna be given to you, you gotta do work, right? Like, anybody who says anything like that, my favorite one is right now and probably maybe forever is Casey Neistat, the YouTuber. He's got a tattoo that says do work, and I was like, that is the stupidest thing, but I will have that thing tattooed on my arm too for that daily reminder of like, unless you put in the work, nothing's gonna be given to you. Like, you have to put in that sort of work. Now, I always like that one from Einstein, like, great, it's back here on my wall, it's covered up there with the door right now, something like, hold on. It's great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. And like, I don't think that I am that, but I think our field and the people that I am with, like, I believe in that sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I'm not a great mind on my own, but us as a community are a great mind, and we have to figure out how to move forward.
And you know, I think that it's important to say that when we're talking in a podcast, because you can get lost in this kind of stuff and get accused of being a narcissist. So you have to kind of preface it where I don't think I'm a great mind. But I think that in your own inner dialogue, when you close your eyes at night before you fall asleep, you have to have the audacity of belief in that you are something, or that you deserve things, or that you have that. You have the aspiration towards that, at least, and not be ashamed to feel that way if that's something that you aspire towards or you feel like you have. Well, so anyway, just to preface that, not because I don't know. I think part of it is like, fuck it, man. Like, who cares if somebody thinks that you're not worthy? It doesn't matter. Like, do you think you're worthy? You know, it's for real. Like, it's other people's opinions are so fucking irrelevant. It's
crazy. And the last thing I was going to bring that into is I do hold up certain opinions of certain people more than I do others.
Sure.
And so, as an example, like the Fryman video that I put out, some people were like, oh, it's really self-promo. And I was like, fuck that, dude.
Yeah,
like,
that was absurd.
But the thing is 99% of the people that I value, like, didn't find it that sort of way. So it's like, cool, I'm not off. Like, you got to benchmark yourself with people that share the same values as you. And like, if someone wants to critique that, cool. You're also going to be critiquing everybody else in that case. And you're going to be critiquing the folks like Fryman, which I don't think would really happen in person. And they'd do those sort of things. But it's, I do what you're saying, where it's like, at the end of the day, like, going to bed, it's like, hey, I'm on track with the things I want to do, and the people I care about say that I'm on track, you know, or they're at least rooting for you still. And that's
exactly,
that's what matters there.
For sure, dude. Yeah. My, I have this, there's this, again, I'm exposing how much of a flippin' sci-fi nerd I am, but whatever. Like, there's this quote from Frank Herbert's Dune, and it's called The Litany of Fear, and I recited it quietly, covertly in my mind when I'm if I'm feeling that moment of anxiety or whatever. It's like, I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that leads to total obliteration. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's I use that shit as like a mantra over and over again.
I have a private list of YouTube videos that I've saved that light that fire for me, or like help me out. And I keep that thing, dude. It's something that, it doesn't work every time, but I've gotten pretty good at like not being in the right mindset, or like being able to like do what you want to do, like the right stuff I can queue up and kind of get me going. One of them's Gary V's 5-minute plea to do. Type in
oh, nice.
YouTube.
Yeah, I know what that is.
YouTube, Gary V's 5-minute plea to do, everybody out there. It's rad, man. He's talking about how you have to start moving forward. And if I could articulate it in like behavior analytic terms a little bit more, until you start putting stuff out there, you're not going to have the data streams that you need to be able to respond to. So it's this idea of, you can create it, but you have to create it and put it out there. You have to get it out there to be able to get those data streams and that feedback. And that's what I've been living by on the daily BA, dude, and this other stuff. Like, until you put it out there, you know what's going to happen. Like, you literally do not have access to the data streams that you need to until you start doing that sort of stuff.
Get the fuck out of your head, man. That's, I don't know. It's like, for me, there's a couple things. Number one, get out of your head, because I'm a person who's lived in my head for a lot of years. And number two is, as long as you're speaking your truth, as long as what you're saying you actually believe and you're being authentic and earnest about it, even if it is offensive, or even if someone doesn't like it or whatever, at least it's defensible, because you're not exuding some faux persona, or you're not exuding some ideology you don't stand by, or you're not speaking to something that you don't actually feel. And to me, that matters so much. And it really removes a lot of those downer feelings sometimes, if I'm feeling that stuff, because it's like, okay, dude, did you tell the truth? Like, is that really what you think? Is that really what you feel? Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe you're wrong, but at least you did not, you know, hide behind some lie or some dishonest way of going about what you think about a thing. And at least now it's out in the open, you know?
For sure.
That goes back to the radical honest thing we're talking about. That's the beautiful thing about radical honesty, is that like, if you live that way, like the only way people find leverage over you, and where I believe anxiety or fear come from, is that as far as like environment, like actual emotional responses, is if you have something that someone can leverage over you, you know, like if no one can ever have leverage over you because everything you do is completely transparent and open and honest, then there, you literally should have nothing to fear other than accidental death. Like that's it. Like, yeah. 'Cause then no one can actually have power over you. There's this great book, there's a man named Viktor Frankl, called Man's Search for Meaning. And he was a Holocaust survivor, and he wrote this book. I think he was a psychiatrist. And he wrote this book basically from a first person perspective with no names, recounting the experience of a man in the concentration camps in Auschwitz and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea behind the book was that there is no name for the character. The idea was that he wrote it so that if someone, as someone is reading it, they become the character and they experience all the different feelings that you feel. And that what he's really though recounting is his own experience. And the whole idea behind it, even in the concept or the place of a Nazi concentration camp, you know, where he saw where people started dying, or when people were more likely to die, was when they would lose hope and they would give up on themselves and they would give up their freedom to choose not to be enslaved in that moment by what was happening around them. And he describes it later in life, how that was that was like his true freedom was actually in the moment when he was closest to that death, because he knew that no matter how what they took from him, they could never take away his mind and his ability to just exist in that way and his will. And dude, Man's Search for Meaning is a serious book. He originally published it with no name, no title, no nothing, because he didn't want anyone to even ascribe it to his experience. But then some colleagues pressured him to do so, and that's why it's his name's on it now. But it's a absolutely impactful, amazing book. But it speaks to narrative. It speaks to the idea that, you know, it's if you're telling yourself the right story, if you're engaging in the right verbal behavior, man, you can get the right motivation going. You know, you can get the right outputs you're looking at.
Yeah, and to tie it back into like that Heinlein article that we can link to for folks, is I was critiquing it a little bit because he's saying that there's a lot of different things that you could look at when it comes to how do you understand its role. And my thing is, like, the better you are at understanding behavior analysis or concepts or principles and how things work, the better you're going to be able, and then pairing that with like your own life and understanding your own situation through those terms, like that's self-management, dude. That's it. That's the essence of self-management, is literally just using our concepts and our terms to be able to understand your behavior and how that data is going. If you can pinpoint and focus in on something to measure, and then you can apply that sort of stuff, you're going to be able to move things forward, to be able to understand what's going around you. Sure, it's hard. Sure, it's not easy. Nothing in life is. The more you apply it, the more fluent you get, right?
Do you find the more you learn about just behavior science in general, the more, I don't want to use the word confusing, but almost like the more supernatural it feels over time? Like, at least for me, it's like, the more, and again, I am not at all a metaphysical person, just to be clear, put that out there. But I mean, like, there, I do appreciate poetry, though, you know what I mean? And there's just the more I learn about it, there's just an elegant simplicity to it that just seems it sings a song about living. When you can, like, the more you learn about the way environmental relations affect people and how, you know, there are all these different things out there that you contact that shape your history and do dictate and affect the way you're going to operate in your life and that kind of thing. And it almost seems like there is a certain serendipity about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that's why you talk about, like, there's some really famous physicists and other scientists that are, like, religious at the end of the day, or they believe in this higher entity or deity, because I think what happens is you start to get a more comprehensive picture. Two things happen. You realize, like, oh, this might be to this divine creation, or like there might be this unifying theory and like entity that kind of created this perfectly laid out world. My understanding is just like you realize there's so many different variables that you now understand and how they work that it just kind of.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, I think it's a combination. It's clarity is really what I'm talking about. I think that if you get to understand the mechanisms and the different things that affect us around us, there is a degree of clarity. And with clarity comes this just, I don't know, it's like that cold calm that's crazy. I mean, it's literally, I keep going back to it, but it's waking up from the goddamn matrix, man. It's like, it's that moment. It's like, it's Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, man. It's a fucking Jedi mind trick. It's unbelievable. Like, there is something absolutely amazing about understanding.
Yeah.
By controlling your environment, you control yourself, and you can, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's fucking Jedi shit, man. Like, yeah, there's no other way to put it, man. Like, it's real life Jedi shit. And like,
and that's where
it's
and
a fucking superpower.
And that's where my example of my colleague is like, if we're trying to understand why someone else isn't doing something, it's like, I don't know if that person necessarily understood the essence of behavior analysis. Like, if you, you know what I mean? Like, if you're not deploying this stuff in every point and area of your life, like, you didn't really get bit by the bug. Like, you didn't have the right adequate supervisor training or experience to really understand just like how radical this is, in the sense of like, it is something you deploy throughout your entire life. And I don't know, man, like, the world just makes sense. It's kind of scary sometimes that it does, or if it doesn't, it's because there's so much complexity into the problem that it's going to take me a lot of time to really try to understand it and whatnot.
But, yeah. And I think that's where, like, to look at the, if you take that idea that you just described, that clarity and that, that's where the arrogance of it comes into play sometimes. I think where it's like, we go almost dark side, you know, Darth Vader level shit, where it's like, you know, there's this arrogance and the superiority that comes with the clarity that you get. Or on the flip side, if we did approach it as a field with some more humility, and we did make it accessible in a sense, and not accessible by simplifying it, because I think that cheapens it. You make it accessible by making it something that people can feel and emote towards, you know, those are different things. And I think that's a mistake that isn't generally that's just an idea that's misunderstood when people talk about it. You can really make it attractive and substantive and something that you really want to touch and play with and you want to interact with.
For sure. I totally agree with you. I've got a call in 5 minutes. I should have warned you beforehand, but this is a perfect time to bring it back around, dude. That was the whole point of Houston, We Have a Narrative, and where we started with this you said it well, man. I don't want to restate your points. The Randy Olson's like, hey, We haven't really tried this in science, and we've seen it deployed elsewhere. Like, what if we tried this? And if anybody's listening to this, like, freaking out because behavior analysts are talking about personality and all this other shit that we've been talking about today, I want to challenge people to look up Let Me Hear Your Voice, the book that put early intervention and behavioral intervention on the map for autism by Catherine Maurice. Go check that out. Talk to any analyst that's out there that's been around from the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. And you'll see the role that that book played. Not that it was the only one, but it's a very important mechanism to why we're even around here today. And it is a pure narrative around a mother who had two children diagnosed with autism, sharing a story about how it versus hugging therapy, behavior analysis versus hugging therapy, or holding therapy, sorry, was what she was trying to understand and grapple with. And spoiler alert, it's behavior analysis and the behavioral approach that she talks about in that book that set our way in our field. So I like this, dude. This was good. Like, narrative's cool, man. There's some important shit here.
Oh, one of my favorite topics. Well, that's why when I saw that you were doing a thing on narrative, I was like, man, I have been down this road deep. My first, when I wanted to do the podcast forever, the first attempt at the podcast was about using narrative. I mean, my Instagram handle is explanatory fiction for that reason. I like the idea of using narrative to shape behavior.
So yeah, dude, the plan is to keep iterating and move off of this. I want to turn it into from a 3-hour to an 8-hour thing. So people know, I'm going to go check out Randy Olson down in Boulder City. That's going to be weird and cool. I'm welcoming anybody and anybody to explore it with me, in the sense of, dude, if you wanted to like jump in and do a workshop with me on it. Like, obviously we got to hit our certain objectives, but I'm going to iterate on this thing hard. I've got another like 8, I think, lined up that haven't been announced yet. And I'm just going to iterate and go, dude. There's something
right
here,
brother. You need to check out. This is a must need for you if you're going to be talking about narrative. And,
Okay. And
it's not behavior analytic.
Read it to folks.
Okay. It's Joseph Campbell's The Hero with 1,000 Faces, and it's the hero's journey. And it's just, again, like, it's not behavior analytic. Okay. To be clear, but it provides a reasonable threshold of stimuli, whatever frames that you could use to disseminate behavior analytic principles in such a way that would make them digestible, in my opinion.
All right, please, wherever you found this, make sure that you go in, comment, tell us how you liked it. Make sure you answer the questions that we left there. and tell a friend. Please tag, share. It is the way that we can start to break through the barriers and share what behavior analysis has to offer and have these more meaningful conversations in a public sphere. Remember, also, you can go to anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange and call in and leave your thoughts there as well, again, privately, where we will be choosing some of our favorites to air on the Anchor app. Our next episode is on self-management and narrative. Finding your story, communicating your story, what role it has in behavior analysis, dissemination. I think you're going to like it. It's just Dimitri and I riffing. Now, I have a quick fun fact for you. That is, did you know that 1 in 1,300 people, that's right, in 2018, 1 in 1,300 people that actually tuned into the content chose to support or help out? So I mentioned Patreon before this. Patreon.com/thedailyBA is a values-based system that I set up to where if you're enjoying this, you can go in, you can support for as little as $1 a month, and you get some sort of exchange as well. So some people receive this in a video series where you could watch online, see us talking back and forth. Other cool things include tiers like the Daily BA, the closed like Facebook group where I share other ideas, resources, things like that. Occasionally I get courses, giveaways to hand out to people. We get discount codes that I share with you. I make that super easy to where you can snag some cheaper rates to big events in behavior analysis. And I've paired up with an amazing artist named Lester who makes these just great, phenomenal, really dope posters of legends in our field that we put out there as well. And you can snag some of those depending on your tier. And occasionally I bring on sponsors through this. I make sure that I communicate that with you. And note sponsors, it's only if we truly, truly align on our value system. So that's our show. There are currently over 94 people in the Daily BA Patreon, like closed group that's accessing these sort of things. I'd love for you to join, so really consider going and checking it out. As a gift for signing up, you get access to all the streams from last year of what we actually produce behind the scenes. You can catch Dimitri and I on Twitter at The Controversial X, that's Controversial EX, or on Instagram at The Controversial Exchange. We will be manning these. We will be answering questions and replying and sharing. So that's how you can reach us in between episodes, in addition to Anchor. And to thank you so much to our listeners, you are the reason that we get to do this. The people on Patreon help us support and make it financially possible. But everybody following, liking, and sharing, you all are helping in this grand vision. So thank you. And I have one last thing that I need to read to you, just so that we're all kosher and we're on the same page. And that is, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast series is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice. That's your Controversial Exchange. Hey friend, before you go, please just do us one small thing. Tell a friend, tag somebody, share this with another colleague in behavior analysis. That is the best way you can help us grow. Remember, you can call in on the Anchor app, anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange. We can actually hear you, reply to that, include them in future episodes. So that is the easiest way to get your voice heard. If you'd like it to be anonymous, just state so when you submit it, and we can make sure that it is completely anonymous as well. Now, another way that you can really help this podcast grow is leaving us a review in iTunes, specifically on the podcasting app for Apple, and it just helps us reach more people. So whether you enjoyed it or not, please leave us a review. That feedback is helpful. Now, you can find us on social media by searching for The Controversial Exchange. Typically, our handle is Controversial Exchange. However, on Twitter, it is Controversial EX, just because we had to shorten that down a little bit. Now, lastly, there are YouTube videos for every single episode now. We are putting them out there. So please make sure you go check that out, especially if you want to see the visual of like what it is and how we're talking about these sort of things. That will be your place. And one last comment, and that is a quick disclaimer. Now, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice.